3 days ago, Agent Lindsay Ferris was captured while on a surveillance operation. This is the man she was tracking. His name is Owen Davian. Details are eyes only, but I can tell you that Davian's a black market trafficker. Extremely dangerous and a priority for us. At 1400 hours today, a recon satellite ID'd a caravan of vehicles with plates matching those known to have been used by Davian's operatives. They stopped at a derelict factory outside Berlin. It appears they have a hostage. We believe it's Agent Ferris. Normally we would disavow, but Lindsay may be the key to getting us closer to Davian, and that's a risk we need to take. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to find Lindsay and bring her home.
Welcome to the James Bond Complex. My name is Matt. I'm your former team leader, now a trainee for the IMF, and I'm here with my two new trainees. Of course, I have Amir Cormier, fellow podcasters, but we have a special guest. We have the one, the only head of section. Of course, it's Joe Dartington from Being James Bond. Good evening, gentlemen. How are you guys doing?
I am terrific. Thank you for this. It's been ages since I've been on the Bond Complex, so this is going to be a lot of fun. Nice to see you guys again.
Yeah, thanks for being on, Joe. It's great to talk to you about anything. So,
thank you.
Glad you're here.
Same here. Thank you.
And tonight, I brought you all here to discuss the third Mission Impossible film starring Tom Cruise. That movie came out in 2006. I know Emery, you didn't see it. Joe, what do you think of the movie, or were you hyped to see this movie when it came out?
I was pretty hyped for it. First of all, the trailer looked pretty spectacular. I mean, just the money shot in the trailer is that scene on the bridge where the rocket kind of knocks him into the car, and then this drone shoots past him at the same time. And it was like, wow, all right, this is looking pretty interesting. And I was kind of a big fan of the first two. So I was definitely, definitely looking forward to this one. I don't want to jump ahead and talk about how I felt about the first two. So.
Well, we already discussed them on the show, but if you want to, I know we brought Bill Koenig for the first one, and he's an old school Mission Impossible fan, and he had some reservations, let's just say, about the first one.
Yeah.
And the second one, we had trouble finding someone to discuss it, because it's the unloved film of the franchise, it seemed, for a lot of people. So I finally had to bring Edgar to discuss that one. But so far, for the first three, do you have a favorite, or do you have a least favorite, or are they on par for you?
Interestingly, well, it's funny, because for me, what's kind of amazing about the Mission Impossible series is that they, unlike other series that start out great and then tend to sort of over time the quality starts to dwindle, which is kind of the norm, the Mission Impossible movies just kept getting better and better. So I just felt like they just kept really amping up and increasing in quality and getting better, to the point where by the time the last one came out, I'm like, this is going to be incredible. Like, I could not wait. I liked the first one. I thought the first one was pretty cool. I wasn't really hooked on the TV show, unlike somebody like Bill. Like Bill is like, that's right up Bill's alley. Is That's a 60s TV spy show. Of course he's going to be like a gigantic fan. So I really didn't know a whole lot about the show. So when I saw the film, I wasn't, particularly crushed that it sort of broke norms. But I could see why, people would be kind of like, wait, what? This is like a solo Tom Cruise movie, even though it's so. I liked the first one just fine. I kind of felt like they were trying really hard to kind of drill the point home. This is a spy movie. You know, this is all about spies, and it's cold, and it takes place in Eastern Europe and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, really good, but, you know, still had a couple of funny reservations about it. The second one, I'm probably one of those rare people that really loved the second one. I thought the second one was spectacular. I like the fact that the plot is pretty neat. You know, there's even like a little line in there when they sort of say, okay, so he, you know, they sort of figure out what's going on. He created the antidote, so he had to create the monster virus to cure. Ving Rhames literally says, "That simple, huh?" And he goes, "Yeah, why not?" And I was like, "Yeah, I guess that's the plot of the film." And it, to me, I kind of like that, because just now we can get on with the stunts and the sort of the sexy look of it and the whole thing. I do think it's a film that is kind of getting high on the smell of its own farts. You know, it is kind of it's a little self-aggrandizing, I suppose, but I'm kind of a sucker for it. Give me a good looking, you know, film. I really think it works. So I was a big fan of that one. So yeah, so by the time this one came out, I was sort of, and it was a couple years after the second one. Like, it wasn't right away. It was almost like they were kind of going back. I think it was like 6 years in between.
You know what? I was reading on that, and they had so many failed start. At one point, David Fincher was supposed to direct the third film. And after that, Joe Carnahan actually quit like days before they started. Like, they added an entire cast. Scarlett Johansson is going to, and I don't know if they had the same script. I doubt it, but you know, the mind goes, tries to, because they had her, they had Carrie Ann Moss and Kenneth Branagh in Joel Carnahan's Mission Impossible 3, his version, but he quit on Tom Cruise at the last minute, and Tom Cruise called Spielberg and said, I want to make a World of Worlds, and in a couple of weeks they turn over and they made that movie instead. But yeah, it took a while for that third movie to happen.
It almost felt like it was almost sort of surprising. I don't want to say, like, I'm trying to think of a, you know, I mean, like, now we're kind of going back and, you know, bringing back old franchises and bringing them back to life and putting new spins on it. I wouldn't go that far. But it did sort of feel like it was like, oh yeah, right. Why not do another one, even though it's been a couple of years? So I wasn't really sure what to expect, but like I said, I liked the first two, so I was pretty excited for the third one. I feel like it took me 20 minutes to answer a very simple question, but
expect the impossible. That was the tagline of one of them. I don't know which one. How about you, Emery? You know, I think you stopped at two for some reason.
I did, because I really, I saw the first one in theaters, and it was, you know, I had kind of had the Bond kind of renaissance of when I was watching the old movies, and I was kind of too young to have seen the Daltons in theater. So my first in theater experience for Bond was Pierce Brosnan. And then the year later comes Mission Impossible 1. And I had no idea of like anything previous to the first Mission Impossible. I didn't know there was a rebooted TV series. I didn't know there was a previous TV series before that. I just went in kind of completely blind. And I really liked the first one. Like, I liked it a lot. And even as a teenager, I remember I bought the soundtrack, which was really weird because I didn't really buy soundtracks yet. I wasn't really, you know, into the music.
Great album,
that way.
By the way.
Great album. That was I had it on cassette, and I really thought it was cool. And then Mission Impossible 2 came out, and I got really hyped because the soundtrack was one of those inspired by the motion picture soundtracks CDs. So you had Metallica, you had there was a Limp Bizkit did the theme song, and so you had all these, like, you know, it was this hype around it. And then I saw the movie in theaters, and I was like, yeah, I don't like this. This is not what I was expecting. I really didn't like the story. I didn't like all the masks. I thought the movie was really super confusing at the time. And I've tried to rewatch it since. And I couldn't get into it by the time the third one came out. I've seen it now and I can appreciate some of its qualities. They have these like big ensemble casts where they get these great actors and actresses to come in to do these first three movies, maybe less so in the second one. I know there's some good actors in the second one, but maybe not as big as the first and the third. So the kind of the hype for the third one, it was really lost on me. I kind of gave up on the series. I almost came back a couple years ago when I saw MI5 was on Netflix. But it wasn't Mission Impossible 5. It was MI5, the movie from the TV show from BBC. So it was an enjoyable movie. But again, you kind of have to know the series to get into it. So, I didn't get the hype at the time because I was really lost after the second one. Me and Val refer to Mission Impossible 2 as masks, 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 because it was just ridiculous how many mask changes were. I know it's part of the show, and I know that was the kind of the cachet of it, was because it was really part of the show, but it was absolutely lost on me.
It's at the time it was an impressive effect, the mask removal. Now you can pretty much pull it off with After Effects and a few green screens. I saw tutorials on it. I know that you guys are a little bit older and you tend to forget things because of age. So I have brought a little
set. You're older than me.
details. I wrote a little synopsis for you guys and obviously our listeners. I'm pretty proud of it. Mission Impossible 3. Here we go. Ethan Hunt has retired from active duty and taken a position as IMF operative trainer. On the eve of his wedding, Hunt receives troubling news from Musgrave, a CIA higher-up. His protege, Lindsay, has been abducted after a daring rescue attempt. Ethan's former student dies from explosive lodged in her brain. Hell-bent on revenge, Ethan returns to active duty and before leaving for his mission, marries his bride, Julia. In Rome, the IMF team is tasked with capturing the man responsible for Lindsay's death. Notorious arms dealers and possible leprechaun, Ovin Davian? That sounds like, it's a weird name. Through the IMF team's skills and gadgets, the Colonel Kingpin is taken, but Hunt's victory is short-lived as mercenaries extract Davian from the IMF's grasp. Ethan then attempts to locate his wife before the nefarious Davian can get his hands on the newly married woman. Unfortunately, Ethan fails again and gets a mission from Davian himself this time. He is confirmed as a leprechaun because he wants Ethan to steal a lucky charm for him, a rabbit's foot. After a few exciting sequences, Hunt acquires the item. But Davian, being an evil leprechaun, extracts his revenge on Ethan by murdering Ethan's wife. Thus ends Mission Impossible 3. No, it wasn't Julia. It was some woman we saw in two shots 15 minutes earlier in the movie. Oh, and Musgrave, the guy that I mentioned earlier in my synopsis, is actually a bad guy. Ethan Hunt escapes, saves his wife, invents the KC fighting method. I'll get back to you on that. Kills Davian, dies, is brought back to life by his wife. And Musgrave also dies somehow. In the end, because the rabbit's foot is just another MacGuffin, we never find out what it does or what it is. Let's just say it's Chimera from the previous film. It's unclear if Ethan Hunt will return. But since there are so many more films after this one, of course he does. That's since Mission Impossible 3. I had fun with my synopsis, by the way. I must mention. I'm pretty proud.
Nicely done.
So, you know, when this movie is brought up, a lot of people talk about its villain, played by the late Philippe Seymour Hoffman. What do you guys think of Hoffman as the villain? I feel like he's the probably the most intimidating villain It's weird also because he's not very physically, it's the attitude that I feel is very thrilling. What do you guys think of Hoffman as our villain here?
I thought it was chilling. I really did. I thought that he was pretty amazing in this. I remember feeling like he was chilling. Not only is he written well, but he's acted well. And I thought, like you said, Philip Seymour Hoffman just really nailed it. And it was funny because I think at that point in his career, he was kind of, you know, he was really doing side roles and he was kind of just the clown usually. I remember he was like one of the sidekicks in Twister, Boogie Nights. He was the awkward friend. He was always doing these kind of goofy kind of, you know, characters that you're not really supposed to pay too close attention to. And then all of a sudden in this, boy, he is just hitting it out of the park. And yeah, he is, you know, they really hadn't had, you know, like a knockout villain up until this point, but boy, they really have one in this one.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. I think his acting was really on point. I mean, he had such presence. He really kind of delivered that kind of like evil, controlling, I'm the boss, you know, overpowering kind of demeanor and presence. And I think that's, I mean, what's one of the things that makes him such a great actor, everything that he's done. I mean, he was in Capote. I'm trying to think of one of the other movies that he was in that you hadn't mentioned, Joe, but I mean, he's been in so many things. The Hunger Games too. I haven't seen The Hunger Games, but I've heard he's good in that too. But the kind of his presence on screen and on stage and things that he's done, I mean, he's always been super well known for that. So using him in this kind of role, in this kind of mysterious villain role, was great. The only thing that I can say about his role, not his acting and not how he portrayed it, but his role itself, I just didn't think it was written great in some parts. I think we were missing just a little bit more backstory and maybe just a little bit more character development, because we're just kind of like thrown in with him. We just kind of meet him right at the beginning. There's that kind of like flash forward kind of sequence,
right.
A pre-title, and then we're just kind of like thrown in with him at that like dinner party thing, and then we get all the rest of it. We don't get like another cut scene with him, or we don't get like a lead up to him. We just get him and nothing else. And not only is the rabbit's foot a MacGuffin, like he's almost a MacGuffin because we don't know anything about him, and it is just kind of, he's there and then he's gone, you know? So I kind of felt that was maybe just a little bit something missing there that could have made it just a little bit better.
You know, I see your point. He's not that in the movie that much when you think about it. I think he's in one four scenes, but
there's no buildup to him. You know, there's like a little bit of a buildup. There's like, you know, a little snippet of it, but there's no.
There's a buildup. I mean, he puts bomb in people's skull. That's pretty twisted.
Yeah. But it was kind of indirectly too. Like that's you know, it was.
We knew it was him, but
we knew later it was him.
He's kind of like to bring up, because you know, we all cover James Bond, but he's kind of like Renard. He's henchmanish a little bit, because he technically works for Musgraves, you know. Not really a villain. Not really.
Like, if I compare that, if you want to use that comparison with Renard did get the kind of like the fire's breath or the hell's. I just covered this with Edgar like 2 weeks ago, when he's holding the rock with all the fire around him. We get that one scene where he's not with Bond.
Yeah, but he threatens Ethan Hunt with, you know.
But he's always with Ethan Hunt.
Mutilation, murdering his wife in front of him. Yeah. And he does it like he never gets afraid of him. He's always in control. Ethan Hunt Tom Cruise loses his.
It's funny because you know who he reminds me of, Emery. I think your point is well taken. He kind of reminds me of Dr. No, where, you know, Dr. No doesn't have any scenes that James Bond is not in either.
Exactly.
He's sort of that same sort of archetype where he's, because we don't know a lot about him, he's sort of in the shadows. So when he does show up, you know, everybody's talking about Dr. No, you know, they're talking about him. And so then when he finally appears, it's like, oh, wow, that's the guy. And I also, I kind of agree with you to an extent. it like you said, it's almost like an extension of the MacGuffin thing, and I kind of feel like that is. This movie does take a few shortcuts, I think, that I don't know that I would make a habit of, put it that way. I think it works fine here. Like, for example, the MacGuffin. I find that to be a little disappointing at the end, just a little bit. You know, I get what they're doing, and they're making a point that it is flat out a MacGuffin, and we're just going to move on and go forward. Okay, I don't know that I would do that a lot, but I think it's fine here. There's a similar scene, not similar, but there's another scene in the film when he goes into the building and you sort of just lose track of Tom Cruise. You, like, Ethan Hunt goes into one of the tall buildings, right? There's a whole scene beforehand where he plans how he's going to get in.
And then he just gets out. Yeah.
Right. And we just do not see him at all in the building. And I kind of thought it was sort of clever because I think what they're telling us is like, well, we've sort of seen him do this routine before. So to follow him in and see what's going on, just we've already done it. So why not just chill out here and then later he just comes bursting out of the building? Yeah, clever and fun. But again, I don't know that I would do that too much. Like, I feel like in here, I'm willing to let it slide a little bit. But I feel like I totally took you guys off the villain because I just wanted to kind of say, Emery, I get where you're coming from.
Yeah. Speaking of the plot and, you know, the MacGuffin, I'm not a big fan of the writers. It's the script is done by Roberto Orsi and Alex Kurtzman, the gentleman who brought us one of them did the Mummy reboot with Tom Cruise. And I don't know if they both work, but they own the Amazing Spider-Man trilogy and the multiverse that was supposed to happen when those movies got released. They're sort of the architect of that. And they wrote, I think, the first two reboot Star Trek movies. And, you know, I thought the first one was good, actually. And the second one was just, I share your enthusiasm towards the TOS crew, Joe. I'm a big fan of the Kirk, Spock, and McCoy.
Yeah.
But the second movie, that bad Wrath of Khan reboot, just...
Yes. I'm 1,000% with you. I thought the first one was really great. I was really impressed with it. I was very nervous going into that first one because I remember the commercials and it kind of had that, this ain't your granddaddy Star Trek kind of vibe. And I was like, yeah. But I
that's
was
what we want.
Yeah. So that I was very nervous going in, but I was really impressed with what they did. I thought that was, it was a very clever way to sort of reboot the timeline. And it's not perfect. It's definitely not perfect. And it gets a little, you know, a little wild, but pretty solid. But yes, that second one, oh boy, that was just painful.
And expect them to go into bold new adventures, and they just remake another one of the old movies.
And the brilliance of the original Wrath of Khan was simply that they realized, hey, we have a whole world. We have how many episodes and so many storylines. We could dive in and pluck one out and have fun with it. And they didn't heed that lesson this time around. They were like, yeah, we don't know what to do, so we'll just redo Star Trek 2. Really? Yeah, and it made zero sense in the big scheme of things, too.
But I mean, J.J. Abrams in general, like any of his movies, I don't think there's one that really stands out where I say, oh, well, this is fantastic. This is a good, great J.J. Abrams film. There's none of them that I can say. I mean, I didn't like his rebooted Star Wars or rebooted or continuation Star Wars. I think that was...
Oh, he killed it for me.
It missed the mark, and then they tried to save it with the second one, which was complete trash, and I didn't even bother seeing the third one because it was just ruining too many childhood memories. So I didn't. And I was a big Star Trek fan before, but I haven't watched those new ones yet. I mean, I've seen like clips and things like that, and I mean, visually it looks impressive, but this whole alternate timeline kind of thing and like rehashing old ideas and.
But my point with bring JJ and the writers, JJ, I think he's a fine director. I think he got better because there are things in this movie that I'm like, oof, TV, oof.
Yeah.
Put this a tripod. Like,
this seems like a movie that could have been a TV, like
It's a two-parter. It's a two-part episode, and I can tell you where episode one starts and episode two begins. But it's a two-parter. It stinks. I think he was just done with Alias when he made that movie. I think that should
right.
just ended, and it reeks of TV for the plot and the direction. I don't like the photo direction either.
It's
weird because it's the same guy that was the DP for 2009's Star Trek, and I feel like that movie looks brilliant, and this one's like, oh, I think they put the contrast and they're trying to hide some of the effects. There's a bunch of green screen that at the time I didn't notice, and since I had training as in VFX, and my eye became better at spotting those, I'm like, ooh, green screen.
I didn't feel it was that bad visually, to be honest. I think the one thing that bothered me the most is how Tom Cruise centric it is.
The first three are all Tom Cruise centric.
But the first one wasn't so bad, because at least the first one, like, we saw the first one, I think, was so well shot, and they used different scenes and different angles, and there's like different shots, and it's Tom Cruise central. I mean, he's the main character, but this one seems almost like it's an episode of Cops, and it's just following the one guy the whole time. There's rarely a shot where Tom Cruise isn't in the shot or coming into the shot. Like
I think you're picking up on something that, I've watched the commentary for this show, and him and JJ were talking about how they wanted this to be a love story, and how the love story was important, and now it's the heart of the movie. And it's to be honest with you guys, I feel like the character of Julia is a prop. There's something called the Bechdel test that it doesn't necessarily equate a good movie, but it's sort of a way to pinpoint a movie that is a little bit too male centric and where the female characters are not, they're paper thin. And also, JJ mentioned something about magic when he was talking about Maggie Q's entrance, and I'm like, oh, this is JJ Abrams and his goddamn mystery box, because he's like, oh, let's he distracts you with the pretty girl and the pretty car, but it's empty. It's just for show. There's something about his movies that are pretty, they're intense emotionally, but they are sort of vapid, and you forget about them pretty quickly after. Like, I'm pretty big on the 2009 Star Trek. I think that movie still holds up, but the second one doesn't. The Star Wars movies are that you want to talk about the third one? It took me like 3 days to watch that movie on Disney Plus. That's the first Star Wars movie I skipped theaters. I didn't watch it in theaters. I was going to go see it only the day that everything went on lockdown during COVID. Yeah. At the tail end of its theatrical run, I'm like, I guess I'm not seeing a Star Wars movie in theaters.
I remember when I saw the third one, I was doing my other podcast. I was doing the movie review podcast back then. We talked
reviews
about
that, without remorse. Plug your show.
Reviews without remorse. I'm still paying $5 a month, so people can listen to it anytime they want. But yeah, when we reviewed it, it was funny. I learned back then that I'm often too subtle for my own good, because I sort of kicked off that episode by saying I liked it just fine. I said it was okay, and I liked it. But the whole point was that I kind of went on to say it's because the second one lowered my expectations to just like a snail on the sidewalk level. Like the second one was so awful and it was so offensive that I had zero. And you knew by that second film, they had painted themselves into such a corner.
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
There was nothing that they could possibly do in that third one that was going to make it better. So I honestly, I just totally checked out. I just like, I saw it. I'm like, you know, fine, whatever.
Bright lights, explosions.
Exactly. Pew, pew, literally.
Lightsabers.
100%.
The third one is an attempt at salvaging the runes of The Last Jedi. And The Last Jedi, it looked for a while like they were going somewhere. Like when he's like, we have to destroy the past. Okay, there. So they're going to do something new. I'm going to blow up all your friends before we do something else. Okay, you're doing the same thing. F you, movie. F you. Yeah. So
back to Mission Impossible 3 for a second.
But you know the love story of Julia. They said they're in love, but you know it's hell don't show.
It feels like a rom-com,
that's insulting rom-coms. I think rom-coms they show chemistry, and it's sort of a crazy man's idea of romance. It's all meh. It's sort of, oh, I love you because you know she's pretty, and I think they're both orphans, so
I think it's
ego stroking from Tom Cruise because every woman's looking at him and sort of.
But it's just a setup to try and kill her later, though. I mean, like it doesn't contribute anything to the story. I mean, there's a term in comic books
called "woman in refrigerator." I don't know if you guys know.
Yeah.
It comes from Green Lantern, the Kyle Rayner 90s version, and is, I think, in the fifth book he appeared on here. His girlfriend at the time gets murdered by a villain and put into a refrigerator. She's just there to motivate him, going, "Oh, yeah. Revenge!" And that's pretty much what she is. She is a prop in this movie. Yeah. All the women are.
Oh, Kerry Russell is like, I mean, when you look at the cast, you're like, this is a really great cast. They've got some really great actresses here. Michelle Monaghan has been known for some stuff. Maggie Q was kind of like, I guess, just breaking out then as an actress. I don't really can't think of anything else she's been in. I know that Jason
was in Prodigy last year.
Right. I mean, she's done some more stuff lately. And then Kerry Russell, I mean, like, isn't that's Jason's favorite. So, I mean,
that's
like,
Jason's imaginary wife.
So when this is all presented to me and I've never seen this movie before, it's a 15-year-old movie or more, and I've never seen it before. I'm like, okay, well, this is going to be really good because this is a good crop. And, you know, Kerry Russell's going to be in half the movie or more. She's going to be an important part.
Oh, no.
And you kill her in like
disappointment.
20 minutes. So it's like, oh, no, she's getting no action scenes. She gets no
one with guns.
Oh, apparently one with guns.
I think she gets one very good one.
She gets one very good one, but you know, arguably compare hers to Ana de Armas in No Time to Die, and Ana de Armas like winner, like handover. Yeah, I mean, she got the best act. She actually got used in an action sequence, and even if she was just there in passing, then at least you know she was useful to the story. Kerry Russell is like half useful to the story. I mean, it just kind of
she's a prop. She's there just to
she's a prop. Motivate. It's the first mission to kind of establish the next mission. And they just kill her like with no remorse. And
they establish that when a bomb blows up in your skull, your eyes go wonky.
Which is a great effect. But I mean, like, other than that, it's like you've just taken an actress and you've paid her God knows how much. You know, I wouldn't call her an A-list actress because I don't know if she was
really A-list at the time.
She was well known for a bunch of stuff at the time. And she was, you know.
Apparently, like once she gets her head about brains blown out, when they shot it, they initially had blood spurts on Tom Cruise's face.
Oh, nice!
And you know, I think for the rating, they went in and erased those because it's just like, oh, that would it's already disturbing because I think you can see the flash in her eyes.
Yeah,
when the bomb blows up, it's just it disturbed me to no end. Which brings me to something that the guy that trained Tom Cruise for his fight near the end against Philip Seymour Hoffman, a gentleman named Justo Dieguez. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name. Sorry, Justo. I actually trained with this man once years ago now, and he also did some fight coordination for some of the Batman movies with Nolan and Quantum of Solace. And the KC fighting right. method that I mentioned in my plot synopsis, it's weird. It's sort of meant for a shorter person than I am, because you kind of use your elbows as a shield, but also a weapon. It's a lot of elbow strikes, and because I don't know if you can hear that, but if you knock on your elbow, it hurts. You hit somebody with your elbow, it's gonna hurt, and you sort of use your elbow. He grabs his head at one point, and he starts fighting. Philip Seymour Hoffman with his elbows.
That's a little Muay Thai too. Muay Thai uses that a lot of elbows and knees and things like that.
I didn't train in Muay Thai. I trained with the man who trained Ethan Hunt, James Bond, and Batman.
Excuse me. Sorry. But wasn't that the same fellow that that trained your friend who became a priest that you had on the show?
I spoke to him recently, but that technique is, I remember that training session. I've never worked out as much as I did. I was laid out it happened on a Saturday and a Sunday. I slept the entire day. I've never been as exhausted after training with this guy. It's KC fighting method, if you're interested or curious. Brought up the love story. Do you have any favorite moments in a movie? Or moments? Depends on.
I definitely have a few. I think one of my favorites was probably. First of all, I think the big, when they're breaking Kerry Russell out, I think that's a great scene in itself, and I remember feeling up until then that I wasn't even sure if I was very impressed with the film at that point, because I remember feeling like, the first two films, you got Brian De Palma, you got John Woo, and they had very distinctive styles. And then all of a sudden this one opens up with this kind of house party, and it just seemed like a whole different genre at this point. And then you're sort of waiting to see what's going to happen. Even the moment where he sort of gets called out from the party and he has to go meet up, and I'm thinking, okay, here we're going to go. He's going to show up at a sexy looking office building, or something slick is going to happen. He pulls up to a 7-Eleven, and I'm like, really? So up until then, I'm kind of like, not too wowed or anything. So when they finally get into that action scene, and that's when, JJ really amps up like the colors, like he's real big on complementary colors and stuff. So you see a lot of blue and yellow and stuff. So that one was pretty good and kind of got me finally on board with the movie. The big scene in the Vatican obviously was another one that really kind of blew me away. And I thought, this is all right. Now we're really back in, Mission Impossible territory here. The one that'll stick with me though, and I'll just sort of pick this one out. The scene where they're interrogating Philip Seymour Hoffman on the plane, and I thought that was kind of brilliant, because I love how, obviously, Ethan Hunt is doing an interrogation, and the guy is just not giving up anything, and he's working hard to get under Ethan Hunt's skin. To the point where, Ethan Hunt flips out, opens up the bottom, the door, the hatch, under the plane, hangs him out. And when he pulls him back in and shuts the door and the smoke settles, somebody says something to him and he goes, "Yeah, Ethan." So like, it's like he got something, like instead of him giving up anything, he actually got something out of Ethan Hunt. It was like, ooh, that was when you really started to feel like, oh boy, this guy is serious. Like it was, he's good. He's just very good.
I'll agree with that scene. I think that scene was fantastic. You see how just cool and cold Philip Seymour Hoffman was, and his character. He stayed in character the whole time. Like it was his character had been like that straight like the entire time. Like he doesn't falter from it. He doesn't show any weakness. It's all business. It's all the time. And the other two seasons you mentioned, I would say that those are kind of the ones that stuck out for me as well. The kind of like final fight scene as well, I think was pretty good too. I think visually maybe a little less interesting, but more the kind of the surroundings being not necessarily as kind of like clean, and like he's in like this dirty restaurant / hospital, whatever at the end.
Yeah,
so I thought that was pretty visually. I'm a little foggy on exactly how it was. I mean, there was
building and renovation.
There was all kinds of stuff going on. Like it was really unclear what the place of business, what kind of business they were conducting. But the other two scenes that you mentioned, Joe, I think the what would really kind of impress me, and of course, because I watch all my movies with my darling wife, we get a little bit of that. Which she said.
I want to know what she thought.
She liked this movie. She didn't love it, but she liked this movie. She liked it better than the second one, because the second one, of course, you know, we refer to it as Mask, Mask, Mask. She hated it. When I said that we're doing a Mission Impossible episode, we have to watch a Mission Impossible movie, she says, is it Mask, Mask, Mask? I said, no. And up until about the halfway point when we see the first mask, then she's like, you said there was no masks. I'm like, I didn't. There was no guarantees. But anyway, What impressed her a lot was she said at one point, this is more of a James Bond movie than some James Bond movies, because there's more gadgets and there's more functional gadgets and there's more actual spying stuff. And I think what one of the things about the, regardless of the fact that it's very Tom Cruise centric, I think one of the things about the Mission Impossible movies that are actually really great, and something that maybe the more recent Bond movies don't do as well, as the whole team aspect was a lot better done in this movie. I think it's a lot more, the Maggie Q kind of performance aside, I think that it was just not well written for her. I mean, Ving Rhames does a great job. Simon Pegg does a great job. The other fellow that they have, I can't remember his name.
Simon Pegg has a tiny little role compared to that other guy that even I'm going to cheat and go on.
It's something Reese. Anyway, he's
Jonathan Reese Myers.
John Rhys Davies is a different guy.
Whoops,
not video. So, but anyway, I think his character was great. I mean, we don't see there's no real character development for him or the Maggie Q character or even a lot of the Simon Pegg character, and it doesn't matter. But they're kind of like the whole team aspect, like the way that
they have an office type relationship vibe.
Yeah, it's like The Office, but like action, you know.
Yeah.
There's a Dwight,
I remember feeling like, you know, I agree with you. They were trying to do that, and they seem to want to get actors that are not going to upstage Tom Cruise, that, you know, like they're kind of younger up and comers types. There's a little bit of, I'll tell you, it's funny. We were talking about with J.J. Abrams before, and we were talking about how he kind of started out strong and then kind of went on to basically destroy our childhoods, but I remember
two different movie series.
Seriously, literally. But I remember back then feeling like he was really good, and I kind of thought he did pretty good with this. But yeah, you could feel that kind of there was a lot of cringy dialogue in a couple scenes. You know, there's one they give one scene with the two of them, Maggie Q and Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. She says something and it's like, oh, it was a prayer I used to say when my cat used to get lost, and he would say, could you teach me? And it was supposed to, I guess it's supposed to be like touching or something. I'm like, this is kind of cringy, really. There was another line earlier. He says something like, Tom Cruise says, do you copy? And he goes, I copy. All I ever do is copy, or something like that. It was like the stupidest line. And I remember thinking like, who's writing this crap? Thankfully it was few and far between. They weren't like, there was just kind of a few. They were just kind of like, ugh, like, I know you're trying to give these folks something to do and give them some character, but
yeah, I think it's better. It's better with Ving Rhames, because we kind of like already have that kind of background for the previous movies. And then you're just trying to like give these other guys like a background, like too soon without kind of like easing into it.
Right, right.
But then you get Simon Pegg, which, you know, I think his performance was really great. I really like Simon Pegg as an actor. I think everything he's done has been pretty fantastic, honestly.
Definitely, you know, from what you told me, Emery, you definitely need to take your wife by the hand and grab her and watch the fourth one, because everything that you mentioned that you like in the third one is actually like there's more Simon Pegg. I think the plot and everything, there are no masks at all in the fourth one.
Oh, there isn't. Okay, I'll
no
tell
mask.
Her. I'll tell her.
But you gotta give this one credit for the mask, though. I thought they really had it was well done. The mask trope perfectly in this one. They went back and.
Yeah. Well, they are doing 3D printing before it was a thing.
Yeah, that's the only thing that was kind of like she looked at. It's like, what? This is a little bit ridiculous. But I mean, it's kind of impressive at the same time, because we have all the second one is like mask, but we never know where the mask comes from. Now we see them make the mask live, and it's kind of impressive. It's geeky and kind of dumb at the same time, but it's also kind of like really impressive that they would do it live like that. And then when, you know, the killing of the wife, I mean, the first scene of the movie, like we get this flash forward of it happening, and we kind of assume that this is what's going to happen. He kills his wife right in front of her, or he shoots her. We don't know. We don't see her die. We kind of assume she gets shot and it shocks him. You know, she's hurt. It's that kind of like pain that he's implicating on him to make him, you know, talk or whatever. And so we get that, and we kind of move on with the movie, and we kind of like build up to that point. Yeah. And then it's a mask, and it's like, oh, for fuck's sake, you know. It's more subtle. You know, the fact that they use it was more subtle.
They explain it, and they go to the process, they take the pictures, and I was remembering a lot of VFX and how they I don't think they do it as much today. I think I'm not sure my VFX knowledge of techniques is, but no, the turnaround to take pictures. There's also the aspect that I like, they explain even the voice chip, even though it makes no sense, because you know the speech pattern is not just the frequency, it's how you speak and your mouth, but you know the little chip can change your voice, and you're gonna speak with a different accent somehow. So they do a lot of work to explain the insanity of the second movie.
The loading of it, and like, you know, the delay, it's not ready yet, and he has to stall because
they didn't need to get the phonics of his voice.
Yeah, there's like a delay, and he's waiting and he's stalling for time because the other guy comes in, and you know, he's trying to make this whole big dramatic thing out of it. I think that was like it's clever. It was a clever thing. I did enjoy the way they did that.
You know, one person we didn't mention at all in this synopsis, in this discussion so far, Lawrence Fishburne as Bessel,
who we initially think is the bad guy. A good portion of the movie we think is the bad guy, unless you're really clever, but I wasn't really clever. I really thought it was him. I mean, Lawrence Fishburne is a great actor. I mean, I've seen him in a lot of stuff, and I mean, I think he's fantastic in everything that he does. I think he was a little bit
He's wasted. Since the Matrix movies, he shows up for a couple of days in those big budget movies. Probably gets paid a lot of money because he shows up in Predators or the Predator? One of the Predator sequels. He shows up like for 10 minutes. He shows up in the second Ant-Man movie. He's in the DC movie. He's in Man of Steel. But he's in John Wick.
Just a horrible movie that my kids were watching. And I can't remember the name of it, but it was just an awful, awful, awful movie. I'm gonna have to look it up so we can mention it, so we can out it. But it's like a fantasy, fairy tale story thing. Hang on, I'll get the name of it, because it was the school for good and evil. He's the schoolmaster.
Sounds like something that I'll never watch ever, ever.
Don't.
I don't have children. I only have to worry about my nephews and niece, and I tend to want to show them movies.
It's based on a book, and it's, you know, the screenplay is by Paul Feig. It's directed by Paul Feig too.
Oh, the greatest director of all time, made my favorite Ghostbusters.
Michelle Yeoh.
By the way, I'm speaking in bizarro speak right now, so everything that I say is
it had a, what I. It had a good cast. Cate Blanchett, Kerry Washington, Charlize Theron. I mean,
a good cast is not, you know, the
really. But it's like when I saw the cast, I was like, okay, well, maybe this movie's going to have legs, but it's a no, Netflix movie.
Everyone needs money. Everyone needs money from time to time. Every movie, every actor has a embarrassing flunkers or flops that they did from the movies. I mean, look at Daniel Craig. Yeah. He was in Cowboy versus Aliens. Yeah.
But I'll say
Sean Connery did Zardoz and the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
But I mean, Lawrence Fishburne, this might be kind of like a phoned in kind of performance. Like he probably took
but he shows days. Up for two, three days, gets paid a lot of money, goes home and
But he delivered like a very dry performance, and it was not horrible. It was, I mean, well written for what he had to do.
Still a professional.
Yeah, but it was, I mean, I'm comparing him to like what I've recently seen him in, like when he gets bad dialogue. He's still performing great, but it's bad dialogue and a bad story and a bad plot. Now he's getting decent dialogue that doesn't really contribute too much to the plot. He's got 3 days of work to do, and he's in and out. He contributes to the movie, and it could have been done by anybody. You could have
He's kind of there just so you notice him, frankly. Like, you know, it's like I kind of feel like they keep trying, like in all the Mission Impossibles, maybe not so much in the second, but I feel like there's always, you know, who's the insider, who's the mole, who's going to betray. So you needed somebody there. Oh, look, it's Lawrence Fishburne. So you focus on him, right? Is he going to be the bad guy? Is he the turncoat? And of course, it ends up being Billy Crudup's character. But yeah, that's right. You just needed like another face, like you had John Voight. Then you had the second one. Why is his name going to pop out of my head?
Doug Ridley Scott.
Doug Ridley Scott. Right. No, I'm thinking of the head of the. The new boss. It's Hannibal Lecter. Why can't I think of his name? Anthony Hopkins.
Right.
So here you needed like another guy, another famous face to play that role. You know, but like you said, I think he's just there to be noticed. Like, hey, look, it's so and so.
Yeah.
Yeah. They keep the same Bond. And the same, they don't keep the same Bond. They keep the same Q&M for decades. But the Mission Impossible movies, they keep Tom Cruise, but the supporting cast changes from movie to movie. They never brought anyone back in those movies.
Vig Rames, and Ving Rames and Simon Pegg. I think the only constants from
there's a character you haven't seen yet that shows up for two movies and. Another that shows has so far shown up for two movies. I think she's in the next one. I don't know if she's going to be in all of them. She might be sacrificial limb. I don't know. But yeah. One last thing I think I want to discuss because you know I'm a fan of movie songs, and that's the thing that as went the same way as the Dodo. They don't do like a movie doesn't have like a song that comes out and has a major hit at the same time. You know, there was Bruce Willis Asteroid movie that had that movie by what's the band with
Aerosmith.
The first Mission Impossible movie had the theme. I think it charted for a while. The second one also, I believe it charted. This third film is the last one that had a song, and I have to remember that it had one. And each time the movie ends and that song begins is when I turn my DVD off because it is god awful. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that because I want your opinion, but
I don't even remember.
I honestly don't either.
There's a song at the end.
Yeah, there's a song like they go. It goes into the Mission Impossible theme, and then it's called Impossible, and it's a song by world famous artist Kanye West.
Is it a Kanye West song at the end of that?
It's a Kanye West song, and it is awful. It never really charted, and it's I think it's embarrassing. It's just.
I think. I think Danny Elfman did a great job with the first soundtrack, and he kind of like refreshed the theme, and that was really great. And I really don't mind the kind of Limp Bizkit Mission Impossible song. I think it kind of almost works, just because Zimmer did the score for the second one. So that was, it was a decent score. And I mean, they had they went out and they took one of the biggest names and most popular new metal kind of rockers to do it. And they did a decent version of it. And I was a fan of theirs.
Of the lyrics. And I know why you want to hate me. It's just like, oh, wow.
Yeah. But I mean, it's like kind of the same way you get that with like Bond themes, like Madonna and Die Another Day, like the Sigmund Freud references kind of.
I love the Sigmund Freud.
I know you guys. Yeah. But like, I think it's horrible theme song.
Not here to discuss.
But like, I didn't even realize it was Kanye West. Oh God. anyway, like I don't necessarily sit there through credits unless I know there's a post credit scene. Like, I won't sit there through credits. When the movie's over, thank you very much. I know who Tom Cruise is. I don't need to see
sometimes
his name
it's
again.
Just because I'm too lazy to stop the DVD, or you know, it's streaming, I'm doing something else and I forget about it, so it goes.
I just turn it off. I mean, I don't have time for that. So I don't remember it. It didn't stand out for me, and I'm not a big Kanye West fan to begin with, so I wouldn't have stuck around for that.
I don't know why he's popular, to be honest with you, or if he was, because I know him more as Kim Kardashian's ex-husband.
And a little bit of a nutcase, yeah.
Yeah, especially that. But I the few things I listened from it, I'm like, this is so not my vibe. I'm like, ugh. But yeah.
He's got one song where he samples Diamonds Are Forever. That's, you know, somewhat listenable. But
yeah, but
other than that,
you said it yourself. He samples somebody more talented that did a better song.
Well, yes, obviously, but
you're not helping.
I'm not helping his argument. No,
helping Kanye West. Yeah. So you know what? I'm glad that you guys seem to have enjoyed this movie. I think, Emery, I got you back into the Mission Impossible train. Yeah. I guess we're all going to see the next one the next summer, but
I've got to catch up, I think, because I got to watch 4, 5, and 6 now.
Yeah, I think some of them are on Netflix.
I'm dying to know what you think of them, Emery, because I'm surprised enough to know that you haven't really seen them. So I'm curious to see what you think going forward.
I'm gonna have to watch 4 over the weekend. Thank you to my sister for lending me her Paramount account. I can actually watch them now. I was gonna buy them on DVD or on Blu-ray. I know that they had the kind of put all 6 onto a Blu-ray at one point, or at least the first 4.
Oh, you always put them in the bundle when the next one comes up.
But I've always wanted to buy the first one anyway, because I really liked the first one. I wanted to have a copy of the first one on Blu-ray, so I figured I'd buy a combo of you know, different movies or the first.
You know
four,
what? The latest printing comes with the sticker for the IMF, the IMF logo that you can put on your car. So I encourage you to buy that and put that onto your minivan next to your kids and stick figures.
I wouldn't put it on the minivan. I'd put it on the other car to cover up some rust spots. But anyway, that's another story for another day.
All right. So I think, do you guys have any other points that you want to discuss? Things that are worth mentioning, or, you know, that you didn't like, that you like?
I would, like I said, I the only thing I would end on is I'm now anxious to hear Emery's thoughts on the next bunch, because I sort of feel like this is, like I said, this is a series that just sort of got better and better. And I think, if anything, you know, the first two, they were sort of they're very distinctive. You know, the first one and the second one had two distinct styles. And I think once you get to the third one, you start to get more of a feel about how the series is going to be going forward. Like, I feel like the three forward starts to get a little more cohesive. So.
They're more the same. Yeah, actually, yeah.
I think that John Woo just has such a particular style, and I think that the plot of the second one at some points doesn't match his directorial style in some respects. So there's some parts that kind of slow down and get a little bit boring and a little bit muddled. because it's not as high paced. And I think this one is a little too quick. Like the pace of the action is just a little bit too fast, and they could have maybe broken it up a little bit. But I mean, if I went from one to three and I just didn't watch two, I think I would have been happy and I would have continued. I think it was two that really kind of threw the wrench in the gears for me. But I'm open to watching Ghost Protocol. I'll have to sit down and take the time.
Cool.
I'm gonna. Oh, I'm getting a text message on my phone, and it's Mr. White again that wants to know if we have people everywhere.
Well, we do have people everywhere. We have the JamesBondComplex.com updated regularly with our content and links to the show that you can listen to on Spotify for podcasters, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and a bunch of other places. If you're on Apple Podcasts, you can go ahead and leave us a glowing 5-star Golden Gun review. You can find us on Facebook at the James Bond Complex, and the same thing for Instagram. And it's at YouTube as well, at the James Bond Complex.
Yeah, from time to time, when one of us wants to put a video out. So, I know, Joe, you sort of put your podcast on sort of hold?
On unofficial hiatus, yeah. Yeah, so I don't have anything new to plug, but so basically, if you want to invite me on your shows, I'm here.
Oh, you still have Reviews Without Remorse to be, and I quite enjoyed that show. I know I'm not encouraging you to do more, but you still have your catalog that, you know, it's fun to dig in and listen to.
Yeah, it is. And we did cover a lot of good ground. We went pretty steadily for almost 2 years, I think, one a week. So we got a pretty good back catalog. So if you want to check out Reviews Without Remorse,
I might actually dig back in because it's been a while. I think I listened to most of your episodes. Mm. I might have to go back and listen to your Mission Impossible reviews now.
Mm. Cool.
All right. So,
and of course, you're the original, you know, James Bond podcaster. So, I mean, you got to go through your back catalog there too.
You should put that on your platform, the original Bond podcast or something. Because it's
200 plus episodes, and they're still out there. So if you're bored and you want to check out some original stuff, feel free.
I've got you on audiobook too. I've got your audio version. I listen to you anytime. It's great.
I got I think I still have my signed copy of your book when I met you in New York.
I got a bottle of Canadian whiskey sitting on the top of my bar that you guys gave me. So thank you.
You still have that? That's not. You haven't polished that?
I dip into it sometimes, but it's. I still got some.
I'm curious now. What did you get them? Because I don't know. I was
a Crown Royal.
Yeah. And then next time I come to Quebec City, I'll get some sausage. It's even better.
There you go.
That's a good one.
That's sausage is a delicious Quebec maple whiskey.
Sweet maple syrup.
Oh yeah, it's like maple syrup but alcohol. It's delicious. It's great. It's wonderful.
And that's a podcast brought to you by Sassanage. No, actually it wasn't. All right. So for now, we're done. Sur ce, bonne soirée. Au revoir.
Bye-bye.
Take care.